And right now I'm very happy to welcome to our program journalist Shane Burley. He's a co-author, along with Alexander Reed Ross, of the October 6th article titled "How the Alt-Right is Trying to Create a Safe Space for Racism on College Campuses," recently published on the Waging Nonviolence website. Shane, thank you so much for making time to come on our program tonight.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So your article is quite a wake-up call in terms of the alt-right, its connections with the Trump campaign, and the work being done to attempt to organize students on campuses in the Bay Area and across the country. Maybe I can ask you, Shane, initially to give us a glimpse of the organizing that you caught on to that was going on in the Bay Area, specifically posters going up around San Francisco and Oakland about an upcoming May 6th event this past spring at the University of California and the Berkeley campus there, specifically at Sproul Plaza, the birthplace of the Berkeley free speech movement in the 1960s. But maybe...
Right. And it's that legacy that they really want to kind of bring back to the public's mind. It was a new strategy for them. What they were trying to do was get under the radar of local anti-racist and anti-fascist organizations and then be able to hold an event that essentially kind of looks good to the media, it looks good to passing students, and it looks good to their own media really well. And so what they did was they only announced it about 48 hours in advance. And so this is a few groups, some of which we know and some of which we don't. The National Policy Institute's been around for a number of years. It's kind of taken the lead in terms of this new buzz around the alt-right. So they recently put on a large press conference in Washington. They've been leading the large conferences. Richard Spencer, who's the director of it, has been kind of out in front fielding, you know, interviews with reporters and things like that. And he's been kind of the person that coined the term alt-right, and he's kind of been maybe like an ideological forefather for it. But then this other group, Identity Europa, is really kind of was doing the groundwork at Berkeley, and they have been, not just in California, but in Portland, Oregon, in the Midwest. There's been sightings of posters from the East Coast, trying to create kind of a nationalist student group, a fraternal organization, as they like to call it, that's going to be on college campuses and appeal to young people, and to try and do what a lot of leftist groups do on campus, which is to create kind of a campus culture.
I wanted to ask you sort of the overview question here. The neo-Nazis and the KKK and other white supremacist groups, you know, carry a lot of baggage, and a lot of folks won't be attracted to become members or activists with these organizations because of their history. What specifically is the alt-right organization's goal here in trying to create another kind of parallel white supremacist culture that I imagine they're trying to avoid the baggage of the older groups?
Sure. And it looks so new that people oftentimes don't see the fact that it has a direct lineage to those organizations in the past. One of the largest organizations in the alt-right is American Renaissance, and they're really well known for trying to, you know, push things like discredited race and IQ arguments, different kinds of arguments about race and crime, things that are kind of pseudo-intellectual, you know, borderline academics, things like that. But they were around since the early 90s and have had everyone from the Richard Spencer crowd, like we were talking about, to Aryan Nations members in their attendance, even recently. So it's the same crowd. It's a rebranding, that's all it is. A lot of the people that are involved with the alt-right, the difference mainly is that they're educated, they're upper middle class, they come out of college, maybe postgraduate backgrounds. That is the real difference. It's not an ideological difference. And so what they're trying to do now is to give you the appearance of what we see with a lot of kind of left-wing, semi-academic groups holding conferences. You know, if the left is going to publish journals, they're going to publish journals. If the left's going to go speak on Berkeley campus, they're going to go speak on Berkeley campus. And what they want more than anything is to be treated as just the right-wing equivalent of a left-wing group, and to try and use arguments like, well, you know, it's just us stating our political opinion, and to try and work their way back into a conversation. If they're able to get back into a conversation, then they're deemed part of a reasonable discussion. And that's something that they haven't been allowed into for decades. Really since people like David Duke. And so what they're using right now is the ability for people to just give them a chance to kind of speak their voice, and they're getting all the runway they can to gain entry to universities, to conference centers, things like that.
Shane, what's been the reception on college campuses like Berkeley and the other universities and colleges that they've tried to organize rallies and recruit members?
It's been mixed. It hasn't been great, generally. They're not getting warm welcomes. Milo Yiannopoulos, who's well-known for writing at Breitbart, he's what you call an alt-light. He's more kind of a diet alt-right. He kind of mainstreamed their opinions without maybe having a lot of the baggage. He's getting challenged at a lot of his university speaking events, but they are sold out nonetheless. People like Richard Spencer, they're not well-known by administration. A lot of the student groups that would challenge him don't really know the baggage he brings in. You know, he's not waving a swastika. He's not coming in a Klan robe. So it's not quite as obvious. And so there hasn't been a large-scale student movement against it. When it's made obvious, it's pretty roundly rejected. What's gone over a little bit better is alt-right students going into Students for Trump organizations. And that's something we've seen on a lot of college campuses. In Portland, Oregon, at Portland State University, Portland State Students for Trump was alleged to be harassing multiracial student organizers, really kind of making a nasty culture on campus. And that's run by, you know, alt-right ideologues, young people that are on these alt-right message boards that are kind of creating a community amongst those. So that's been kind of their entry to get a little bit more high profile. With groups like Identity Europa, it's really too new to tell. Anti-fascist organizations off campus have been responding really strongly to them, but it's yet to see if they're going to have much of a pull on campus.
Shane, are these groups at all associated with violence, whether you know, directed at particular students or student organizations anywhere around the country?
I think the answer is yes and no. Their entire existence, the entire way they function, their talking points, their messaging, their branding, all of it is based around the idea of taking their white nationalist message and stripping away the connotation of violence. The problem is that white nationalism is a history of violence. It's completely inseparable. So you take Nathan Domingo, who founded Identity Europa, and he will strip all forms of racial slurs and violent language out of his discourse. But, of course, you know, he served over 5 years in prison for violently attacking a Muslim man. American Renaissance is a really great example. You know, yeah, they will talk about, you know, peaceful politics, this and that. But if you look at the crowd, you're going to have skinheads. You're going to have neo-Nazi party members. You're going to have Klansmen. And the same is true of League of the South, Council of Conservative Citizens, all these groups that have a kind of close, tight network and kind of make up a lot of the core of the alt-right. And then at the same time, do you have groups that have been associated with the alt-right that are actively recruiting from that kind of more violent undercurrent? So the Traditionalist Youth Network, which we mentioned in the article, they recently held an event in Sacramento, and they decided to invite Golden State skinheads and Sacktown skins, two skinhead gangs, and ended up stabbing seven counter-protesters. I think eight or nine people ended up in the hospital. So this is something that happens relatively regularly when you have this long history of this kind of violent confrontation. And it's really hard for the alt-right to completely reject it because it's something that's really baked into their ideological legacy.
We're speaking with journalist Shane Burley, a co-author along with Alexander Reed Ross of the article titled How the Alt-Right is Trying to Create a Safe Space for Racism on College Campuses. And Shane, if you had to distill the ideology of these groups down, as well as their goals, down to just a few words, I'm getting that it's a continuum from the KKK and Nazi and other older school white supremacist groups of pure and simple white supremacy. But are they advocating any sort of longer term goals here, like a separation of the races, or, you know, I'm just wondering what their key points of discussion are when they speak on campuses or anywhere else and try to recruit members.
Right. I mean, if you're going to boil one ideological thing down, it would be inequality. They believe human beings aren't equal. whether that's between races or inside of racial groups, they believe that inequality is natural and they should create a society where inequality is allowed to flourish. So that means a very highly hierarchical, stratified society. But in terms of vision, it's almost universally a white ethnostate. It would be a country that's dedicated to white people. Sometimes they talk about breaking it down into, you know, ethnic enclaves inside of that white territory, but generally it's about how to create a white enclave, and usually on the North American continent, which would mean expatriation of non-whites, reservations for indigenous folks, things like that. So it would be a complete separation of the races. And it's also not an entirely new concept. I mean, this is something that Klansmen and neo-Nazis have been talking about for decades, trying to create, enclaves for African-Americans maybe in the South, and that they get the Northwest. There's all different kinds of visions of it, but that's almost universally it. There's also a universal anti-Semitism to it, which has been very strong and ongoing. And there is a real strong sense there also of male tradition, of the need for masculine authority, to put women back in their places, to maintain traditional gender roles. So it's kind of a lot of those, what we see really traditionally with white supremacist organizing and ideas, just kind of trumped up in the language a bit.
Now, when these groups advocate separation of the races like this, like you're describing, it inevitably involves violence. Because certainly these groups that they want to separate from are not going to be cooperative in this project. So we're talking about the use of force to establish this new white supremacist state. Are they explicit about the use of force as part of their program?
They are cagey, to say the least. I think Richard Spencer, for example, calls it peaceful ethnic cleansing, and he cites the Balkanization of the USSR, he cites early Zionism, and other things that, frankly, were incredibly violent and had incredible levels of ethnic sectarianism. And you see this also from Southern nationalist organizations, which really have kind of wrapped into the alt-right in a lot of ways. Sometimes they argue, oh, well, we'll use some kind of tax system to make it, uncomfortable for non-whites to live in our ethnostate, or we'll offer incentives of some sort. But when it comes right down to it, they're going to enforce those boundaries by whatever means necessary. So I think it's something they really want to avoid, putting in those terms, making it black and white like that. But it's something that's always there. And I agree, I don't think that there's any way for them to achieve any kind of ethnically homogenous vision without the forced removal of millions and millions of people, which is inevitably violent, incredibly so, cruelly so.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask you this. Given the fact that there's some crossover between the alt-right, the Trump campaign generally across the nation, and some of these alt-right efforts on college campuses, and the Trump campaign at colleges and universities, what can you tell us about the success of these alt-right groups for a post-election recruitment drive of these Trump supporters, these younger millennial Trump supporters?
It's really hard to say at this point. I think that they're going to likely consolidate efforts at some point. I think it will actually radicalize them more. What they've been talking about over the last several weeks, almost universally, is that Trump is really their last chance electorally. Outside of Trump, it's an entirely revolutionary vision for them. And in a lot of ways, that returns them to their traditional language of being, at war with the U.S. government, or being at war with the conventional populace. So I think it's going to radicalize them in that way, and they might skim off the surface a bit of people who were very committed Trump Republicans, young Trump Republicans, and they're looking for a political home afterwards. But I don't think that they are going to increase in numbers if Trump loses. I think that the level of crossover that they've enjoyed has only come from a Trump presidency. If Trump is gone, the GOP will strip remnants of Trump from it, looking at a losing strategy. Breitbart and other kind of organizations that have kind of been a crossover point for the alt-right, maybe they've mainstreamed some of the alt-right's talking points. They're going to move on to the next populist thing, the next popular thing in conservatism. They did this with libertarianism before and the Tea Party before that. So I think it's they're going to lose a lot of their sounding board and a lot of their megaphone. And they're going to shrink. Now, one thing that the Richard Spencer likes to say is you can't unring the bell. I think that they've grown exponentially because of this in really huge and very surprising ways. So I think people who are concerned about the rise in these groups have something to be concerned about no matter what happens. But I do think that a Trump loss is going to be a kind of a very serious blow to them.
One thing that's concerning, Shane, is the fact that these alt-right folks like the Trump campaign manager, Stephen Bannon, you know, the head honcho over at Breitbart, these folks have become very mainstream now within the Republican Party. And although you think the Republican Party will somehow dismiss these folks and maybe excommunicate them after a losing election and Trump is out of the picture, could it be that the Republican Party is so stripped down at this point to just these hardcore elements, advocates, you know, either blatantly or covertly white supremacists, that these elements could take over the Republican Party and push the, you know, inside the Beltway corporate Republicans further to the margins?
I mean, if Trump won, I think that's certainly possible. I think it's really true that conservatism in the Buckleyite movement of the 50s and 60s, the National Review movement, has really died as an ideological movement. It was something really based in the Cold War, maybe reaching its zenith with Bush and neoconservatism. But since then, it's really looked for an identity for the party, and it hasn't found one. The Tea Party was an opportunity. So was the libertarian moment. And this is this right populism is another kind of quest to reclaim a soul for the Republican Party. Someone like Steve Bannon, I may actually kind of believe that he is less ideological than he appears now. Seeing the way that Breitbart has kind of shifted points of view over the last several years to whatever seems to be hip, whatever's kind of clickbaiting. And I also don't know what connection he's going to have to Beltway conservatives if someone like Trump loses. But if Trump does win, that sends a real strong message. It sends a message to the Republican establishment that this is the politic that wins. Just like in the 50s and 60s, anti-communism, traditional values and kind of pre-neoliberal politics is what won then. And so I think what comes from this election will be that message. The other thing is that with Hillary Clinton heading to the center, it also sends a message that a lot of those Beltway Republicans are now welcome to the Democratic Party, which I don't think is a real positive for most Democratic voters either.
Shane, there's been some speculation that maybe Donald Trump didn't want to become president anyway. I mean, whether it's conscious or unconscious, he's certainly sabotaged his own campaign almost on a daily basis. But whether, you know, what his real objectives are, I don't think we'll ever know. Maybe he doesn't even know. But there has been speculation that after the election, it could be that Steve Bannon from Breitbart, who's now heading up the Trump campaign, and other folks, some involved in the alt-right, could very well get together and form some kind of national and quite high power media project that's a hub for promoting the views of the alt-right in this white supremacy.
I think that's actually a real possibility. I think that, though, what will happen even inside of that is actually a rejection of the hardcore element of the alt-right. It's already happening. People like Milo, Gavin McGinnis, formerly of Vice, and Steve Bannon, all of them have kind of, after being associated and taking some of the kind of points for the hip movement of the alt-right, have started to back away from its more hardcore claims as it gets exposed. So I would see them, if they were to do a project like that, or they were to invite folks to do a project like that, I think that might even betray the hardcore line. I think it's very, very hard for the alt-right to maintain its crossover into the culture for much longer. If that was the case, people are going to start having to answer questions about anti-Semitism, about really defined racism, race and IQ arguments, race and crime, they're going to have to start answering questions about that that people like Steve Bannon are not willing to answer. And so if they were to form a project like that, I think you would see something a lot closer to what we have with Breitbart now, maybe a little bit more to the right, but I still think that if they were to, if Trump was to lose and they were to create their own media project, they probably would create a wall for the more hardcore elements.
Well, just a final question for you. It's interesting that most people had not really heard or discussed to any great extent the alt-right until Hillary Clinton used that terminology in a speech, you know, about a month ago or some weeks ago. And I'd like to ask you what kind of job you think our corporate media has done in covering this element that's on board the Trump campaign, this white supremacist grouping that, you know, has very extremist views, but until Hillary's speech on it really hadn't been called out by the media.
I mean, it's been atrocious. But it's been atrocious before and after. It's been atrocious from even the nonprofit establishment that we usually get to profile groups like this. What you saw in a lot of profiles of the alt-right shortly before Hillary's speech, when they first kind of rumored the topic would be, and then shortly after, was this parroting of the idea that the alt-right is either A, just a Trump Republican, or B, it's this kind of iconoclastic, hip youth who likes to offend people. And they miss the really long lineage of anti-Semitism. And when I say anti-Semitism, I mean very hardcore Holocaust denial, to conceptions about Jews running the media and running investment banks, real Nazi kind of mythology, really hardline racism. That wasn't covered. And neither was it covered that these organizations, the ones that are propping up the alt-right, the ones that are the ideological founders of the alt-right, the ones that are publishing their articles, running their podcasts, these institutions go back and they have connections that go back decades. That there's a lineage of these white nationalist organizations, none of that was covered. And I think in part it was that a lot of these reporters never thought that they would have to cover this until now. But it also just came from the fact that a lot of people couldn't actually believe that hardcore neo-Nazi types were influencing the presidential election. I don't want to give kind of round. There was, Jason Wilson at The Guardian did a great story. There's a guy at Huffington Post who's doing some great work. So there was some good coverage of it. But in general, it's been really tough getting that. And also, obviously, for the year or two before that the alt-right has really been increasing, it had zero coverage. And so there was this universal belief that these people didn't matter, that they were irrelevant, and that they were never going to come up in public conversation. And even for those of us that monitored them pretty closely, to see it come this fast and this hard was a little surprising. So I think in general it's been covered pretty poorly, and that hopefully as time goes on and they make themselves a little bit more obvious with their rhetoric, with their messaging, that's starting to change.
Well, Shane Burley, thank you so much for spending time discussing some of the important points in your recent article, co-written with your partner, Alexander Reed Ross. The title of the article we've been discussing tonight is How the Alt-Right is Trying to Create a Safe Space for Racism on College Campuses, and it's a window onto some frightening strategies and the ideology of the alt-right and the links to the old-school white supremacist groups along a scourge of this country. And Shane, tell our listeners how they can find this article on the web and some of the other articles that that you've written and will be writing.
Go ahead and check wagingonviolence.org. I wrote that there. I write articles for them a number in the past. Also shaneburley.net, and then search for me on Twitter.
Okay. Well, thanks. Appreciate you being here, and I hope we'll stay in touch. You're doing a lot of very important work here, getting a lot of the details out about these folks, and we need to know what they're up to. Thanks a lot, Shane.
All right, thanks for having me on.
Take care. That's Shane Burley, co-author again, of the article, How the Alt-Right is Trying to Create a Safe Space for Racism on College Campuses.